majority note speaker is Don Kay from Rancho Cucamonga.
Thank you. I'm Don. I'm an alcoholic. April 5th, 1969, there's an ambulance racing through the night in northern New Jersey. It's been raining out, and the pavement is black, and there's a mist coming up off the pavement. The lights are flashing, the red lights, and the sirens are screaming. And in the back of that ambulance is a young man. Not breathing, no heartbeat, no signs of life. And they're doing CPR. And behind that ambulance are his parents, driving along, trying to keep up, not speaking to one another, just thinking about their son, their firstborn, their only son, thinking about all the hopes and dreams that they had for him, about his first day in school when he cried because his mama dropped him off, and thinking about the first time he went fishing and caught a trout with his dad, and the first time he got a hit in Little League Baseball, and thinking about how they hoped he'd grow up one day and maybe go to school and get a good profession and get married and have kids. And now all of that looked like it wasn't going to happen. And finally they get to the hospital and they rush the young man into the clinical area, and the parents are sent into the registration room. And once they get that information, they ask him to sit, and they just sit silently praying for their son. And finally the doctor comes out through the swinging doors and walks over to him and says, I don't think he's going to make it. He's not breathing. We can't get a heartbeat. And I don't know if he had planned to turn around and go back, or if he just couldn't take looking at the look in their eyes. But he went back through those double doors and went back to work. And finally half an hour went by, and he came back again. And he said, we got a heartbeat. He's starting to breathe on his own. I think he's going to be okay. And of course, that young man in 1969 was me. But I wasn't done yet, not by a long shot. I had jails to go to and treatment programs to walk out of and lots of trouble to get into, lots of more overdoses. I grew up in a family where, I gotta tell you, these are all my perceptions. Clancy talks about the disease of perception. This is how I saw things. If you were to ask my sister if this is how things happen, she might tell you something different. But this is how I saw it through my eyes. So it's as true as I know it to be. Well, I grew up in a family where drinking was an important thing to do. It was important to know how to do it, for a guy, at least. If you were a woman, that didn't matter so much. But it seemed like the guys had to know how to drink. And I remember people in my family talking about drinking like a man and learning how to hold your liquor. And I don't even know what those things really mean, but it was important to know how to do it. And everybody, you know, all the men in my family drank. A few of the women, but all the men drank. And none of them would have called themselves alcoholics. I mean, as long as you don't, an alcoholic is somebody that's out on the street corner with a bottle in his pocket. That's an alcoholic. But in my family, as long as you go to work, as long as you pay your bills, get up in the morning to go to work, as long as you drink at home and don't drink in a bar or on the street corner, you're not an alcoholic. It doesn't matter how much you drink. It doesn't matter if you beat up the old lady when you get home. That's not what it's about. It's about going to work and being responsible and doing all that stuff. But we did have one alcoholic, and that was my Uncle Russ. And Uncle Russ was an alcoholic because he got in trouble when he drank. You know, in my family, you could get arrested a little bit, and that was, but you can't get arrested a lot. You know what I mean? If you got arrested on Saturday night for fighting, that would, you know, you could get through that. But Uncle Russ got arrested a lot. He had traffic accidents. Uncle Russ finished all of, served in Guadalcanal and the Marines, and came back and went to school. Took all the classes to become an attorney, except the last two classes, and he got a job working as a bartender instead of going to class, and never finished his law degree. And that's how he did everything throughout the rest of his life. He'd get a job. I remember one time he got a job loading trucks, and pretty soon he was the yard manager, a yard foreman, and then he was the manager, and And then he went out and got drunk and went through the windshield and ended up in the hospital and got arrested. And he just did. And my dad's job in the family was to go rescue Uncle Russ. Go rescue Uncle Russ and bring him home from jail or the hospital or the flop house or wherever it was and bring him back home to heal up at our house. Which was wonderful because I loved Uncle Russ. He was my hero. He was just a great guy. He'd take me down to the XL bar. You know, I was just little. And he never gave me any liquor. Never gave me any. But he'd sit there and he'd have a shot of Jack Daniels or a shot of bourbon with a beer back, a little short beer. And he'd do the New York Times crossword puzzle. And he could do the whole thing. I never saw anybody do that before. And I'd sit there and drink my Coke right at the bar, you know, at 10 years old. And I'd think I was cool. You know, I was the coolest guy in town hanging out with my Uncle Russ. Well, I knew that I had to get drunk. I knew that getting drunk was something important to do. Now, I don't know how I knew that, but I knew it. So I went to Uncle Russ when I was about 11. And we always had beer in the refrigerator in my house. And I said to Uncle Russ, "Hey, Uncle Russ, how much beer would you have to drink to get drunk?" And he said, "Beer? You can't get drunk on beer." "Beer's a beverage." "Beer is something you drink when it's hot out so you can cool off. If you want to get drunk, you got to get whiskey." And we didn't have any whiskey in the house. So I didn't know what to do with that information. But around Christmas time that year, when I was 12, a screw-top bottle of wine appeared in the refrigerator that someone had given my dad as a Christmas present. And I went to Uncle Russ again. I said, "Well, how much wine do you have to drink? Because you get drunk on wine." And he thought for a minute. He rubbed his chin and thought for a minute. He said, "Well, I guess you could get drunk on wine if you drank enough of it." So I said, "This is my chance." So I started snitching out wine, putting it in a little cup, and then bringing it down the basement. We had a canning rack in the basement with mason jars, and I got two of them about halfway or two-thirds filled up. And the day before Christmas, I went down there and just chug-a-lugged them all by myself. And I, first of all, I thought it was going to taste like Welch's grape juice. And it didn't. But I drank them down. You know, I knew I had to do this. And I stood there in the basement thinking, why on earth would anybody do something like this? It doesn't even taste good. It doesn't taste like grape juice. And I was looking at, there was just one light on at the other end of the basement with a pull chain, just hanging from a wire with a pull chain. And I started laughing. And I was uncontrollable laughing. And I got that, and I started to get that warm feeling I could feel it when I breathed. I felt that warm feeling in my belly, and I could feel it in my chest and my fingertips. And the world was funny. Everything was wonderful. Everything was great. I went upstairs, and my sisters were sitting there watching TV in front of the Christmas tree, and I just laughed at them. Everything they did was funny, and of course they got mad because they always got mad, and told my mom, and she came in and wanted to know what was going on. I didn't cop to nothing, you know. I finally went upstairs and took a little nap, and I woke up with a headache later on that afternoon. But no worse for wear, you know. And I thought, I like this. I don't know when I'm going to get some wine again, but I'm going to put a bookmark here because I want to come back here again. And I grew up in a town where in the junior high school. Now, these are all my perceptions. When you got to be 14, you had to decide what group you wanted to belong to. And we had three groups in my high school. We had the nerds, the guys that did their homework, you know, and went to class. And, you know, the jerks. I'm sure you had them out here, too. Pocket protectors. And I didn't want to be one of them. There's no way on earth I wanted to be one of them. And then we had what we called collegiates or jots. They were penny loafers and white chino pants and madras shirts back in those days. And they wore their hair like kind of beetle cuts. And they were kind of the teacher's pet guys. They all played football and were nice kids. And I didn't want to be one of them. You know, I didn't have the money anyway. You know, I had two pairs of jeans. If I had one on, the other pair was in the wash. And if I had gone to my dad and said, "Oh, I want penny loafers because they're stylish and you know, white chino pants. He'd have laughed at me. We just didn't have it. We weren't poor, but we didn't have money for, you know, that would have been a luxury in our home. But the other group were the Hoods. I like the Hoods. Did you ever see The Sopranos? I'm from Soprano land. I'm from the part of New Jersey that The Sopranos come from. And I like the guys with their hair combed back and the black leather jackets. And those were my idols, you know. I like those guys. So walking home from school when I was 14, I combed my hair back, kind of like it is now, and became a Hood. And that was it. And I was started hanging out with the guys. And I was walking home with Larry Pichetto a few weeks later. They weren't all Italian, but it seems like they were. Anyway, I'm walking home with Larry Pichetto, and Larry says, "Hey, Don, have you ever been drunk?" And my ears perked up. I says, "Yeah, I've been drunk." I didn't tell him it was down the basement by myself. He said, "Well, can you get some money?" I said, "Yeah, I can get some money. I cut lawns on Saturdays. I had some money." He said, "Well, there's a dance Friday night, and me and Pete are going to get some whiskey. Do you want to come with us?" I said, "Yeah, you better believe it, man." So for $1.67, I got a half pint of Fleischmann's blended whiskey, and it was good. And we met out behind the junior high school, and I had an Orange Crush chaser, and I chugged that whiskey, and I drank that orange. It was wonderful. I had the best time of my life. Alice Higdon was one of these early developing 14-year-olds, if you know what I mean. And in those days, with a bouffant hairdo, you know, with the hair that went up like that, and then bangs, and then a little bow in the front. And she came by and sat on my lap, and it was like I was in heaven, you know. And her girlfriends were with her, and we all talked. It was wonderful. It was just, and I knew, you know, walking home that night after curfew, late, walking home, my feet didn't even touch the ground. I was the happiest guy on the face of the earth, and I knew that this is what I wanted to do. I didn't want to go to college. I didn't want to study. I didn't want to take these stupid classes that my parents wanted me to take. I wanted to hang around with my buddies and get drunk and chase girls. And when I got a driver's license, race cars. And that's all I really wanted to do. Nothing else. And that's what I did. And I got home late that night and I got put on restriction. My dad was a Navy guy, so he really wasn't a disciplinarian, but he thought he was. You know, he thought he was, you know, tough. So, but I got restriction whenever I violated the, you know, the big rules like curfew. Well, restriction meant, restriction was always a month. And restriction meant that for a month, I wasn't allowed out of the house. I had to come straight home after school. But what it really meant was, on Friday night or Saturday night, instead of going out the front door, I had to climb out the window onto the roof and jump off the roof and go get drunk with my friends. And then I got another 30 days restriction. And it didn't matter, because I had restriction until I moved out of the house at 18. I also had detention every single day for my entire high school career. Everybody else got out at 3 o'clock, I got out at 4 o'clock. And I never really understood why, but somebody, I was talking to somebody before. I also wasn't allowed to park in the parking lot for, well, it was either for fighting or for burning rubber, you know, patching out in the parking lot. And they didn't like that, so I had to park out on the street. I was always in trouble, and I'm not saying that's because I'm an alcoholic, or I don't know, because I met a lot of alcoholics that never gotten that kind of trouble, but I always did. You know, that's the kind of stuff I did, and I love getting drunk, and I love getting in fights. Somebody, when I was a kid, no, I'm too old now, but when I was a kid, I did, and somebody said to me one time, "You sound like you were very violent," and I thought, that's kind of strange. I never thought, you know, it was more like a hobby. Getting in fights, you know. I wasn't mad at anybody. It's just that's what we did, you know. I belonged to the tarantulas. That was the name of my gang, you know. When we got in fights, we fought with the scorpions, you know. That's what. Did you ever see West Side Story? The Jets and the Sharks. The Jets and the Sharks. Well, so we saw that and we said, well, that's what we want to do, you know. That's how things were. No, and then the 60s came along and drugs. And I like drugs too. You know, I know this is AA and I respect all of our traditions, but I could never get enough drugs. You know, I just loved them. And it didn't really matter what it was to me. But I never let drugs get in the way of my drinking. I just drank right along with it. You know, I like doing blue barrels, acid back in those days. And Here's some blue barrels and a pint of bourbon. I like bourbon. I learned that from Uncle Russ, you know. And just chug a lug of that bourbon. I could drink that pint in two gulps, you know. Just chug a lug of that and take the blue barrels. And but you can't fight. Just in case anybody's thinking of going out. In my experience, you can't fight very well if you're doing acid and drinking. There's too much commotion going on, you know. Even if it's one guy, it looks like there's a whole bunch of guys after me here. Then I started getting arrested, you know, and I got into... I went out to... My dad... I never finished my... I barely finished high school. I graduated high school at the very top of the bottom half of the class. And my dad... My dad yanked me out before the graduation ceremony and sent me out to Montana, where he was from, for big sky therapy. So I never got to go to graduation from high school. But it was probably a good thing, because all of my buddies got arrested right after that. So it was probably for the best. And I flunked out of college, got all Fs, didn't pass a single class. I went back to... Went back to Jersey, and I was doing a little heroin here and there too, you know, at the time, and you know, just other stuff. But I went back to Jersey, and I was persona non grata in my parents' home because I had flunked out and I was writing bad checks. And I was hanging out in town, and I didn't know where I was going to sleep, and it's cold. This was in December, you know. It's cold in Jersey in December. There's snow on the ground. There's a foot of snow on the ground. And one of my buddy's girlfriends said, "Well, you can stay at our house. My mother will let you stay there." And I looked at her, and you know, nobody was allowed to hang around with me. I didn't have any friends whose parents allowed them to hang around with me. So I thought that was a strange thing to say. And I said, "She'll never let me stay there." She says, "Oh yes, she will. She's an alcoholic." And I thought, what on earth does that mean? But I had no place to stay, so I went over and met her mom, Peggy W. And she said she was a big Irish lady. I mean, she was kind of overweight, but she was just a big lady, big husky lady with a shock of red hair, and a wonderful laugh. And she said, "Well, I don't have any extra beds, but you can sleep on the floor. I got a sleeping bag." And I thought, well, that's better than sleeping in the snow. So I moved in there. She had, I think, 3.5 years sober in this program at the time. And she started, first she started talking to me about her drinking, which I thought, this is the coolest lady I've ever met. She had dislocated her husband's shoulder one time when she was drunk, and he was trying to restrain her, and she flipped him, and I thought, well, that's pretty cool. And she was a vodka drinker, and she'd hide her vodka, you know, all around the house. And one time she put it in the clothes dryer and put the family's clothes in there. She said they were mad at her for weeks picking little shards of glass out of their clothing. But I thought that was pretty cool. And then she started talking about living a spiritual way of life, and I thought, well, I already am pretty spiritual. You know, I smoke a lot of pot. And she said, well, no, I mean being sober. And I said, well, I really am sober, because I only did mostly acid and beer right then, and you can't get drunk on beer. And acid, I always thought of acid as sort of a cleansing agent, you know. It cleans your thoughts, you know. That's how I viewed it anyway. But she wanted me to go to one of these ANA meetings, and I had no place else to sleep. So I said, well, sure, you know, I'd be happy to go. And but the night before, what time should I finish? 9:25. Okay. So the night before, I got a call from this old girlfriend, Marga Ducido, she said, "Hey Don, have you ever done crystal meth?" And I said, "Well, no, I never have." She said, "Well, I got this buddy that's dealing, and I'm sure he'd be happy to give you some if you want to come over." And I thought, well, I mean, you can't pass up an opportunity like that. So it was Friday night, so I went over to her house and slammed some crystal meth, and it was wonderful, you know. It was very, I talked a lot, you know. I didn't, but then when I got back home, nobody told me you couldn't sleep on that, you know. And I got home and my eyes were just like pie plates staring at the ceiling, and I And my thoughts are just going round and round and round all night long. And finally, the sun is coming up. I haven't slept at all. And Peggy comes in and says, well, we're going to this A&A meeting. And I thought, oh, man, this is... So we got in the car and drove over to the Catholic Church, which I didn't know was in a church, or I might not have agreed to it. But it was in the rectory of the Catholic Church, which I think is the house where the priests live, although I don't really know. And it was in the basement. We went down the basement. It was kind of a room kind of like this, but a little more narrow, with a table in front and a little kitchenette at the end. And all I really remember is this guy come out, Frankie or Joe or some New Jersey name, comes out carrying a birthday cake, singing happy birthday. And there were only three people at this meeting. And I thought, oh, great. I mean, if this is what these losers want to do, I mean, God bless them, these poor AA people. If it helps them to do whatever they want to do, that's wonderful. But this isn't what I want, not at 18 years old. I mean, I don't want to go to these meetings, and I don't want to work those steps. I mean, I want more drugs, and I want more alcohol. That's what I want. So I didn't grace these rooms again for many a year. I went on to get arrested a bunch of times, flunked out of college again, another college. Finally got mandated to a drug treatment program in New York, and I was there for 27 months in residential treatment. But as luck would have it, the program I was in was a drug program and not an alcohol program. And this is the truth. And they said to us, you guys are addicts, you're not alcoholics. I got it busted for heroin back in those days. You guys are addicts, you're not alcoholics, and it's okay to drink as long as you drink responsibly. I could live with that. I could live with that. So I finished that program, but I knew that I had a not that I was alcoholic, but I had a tendency to overdrink. I don't. Any of you guys have a? I had this overdrinking problem, and then I would do embarrassing things and get into these pickles, And so I wanted to go back to school. I really wanted to go to college, and I'll just throw this little story. And I applied to the local college, and they turned me down. I mean, I only flunked out twice. And so I called him up and I said, isn't there somebody I can talk to about this? And they said, well, yeah, you can come in and talk to the dean of students. So I'm doing construction at the time. The only time I can come is after work, because I got to work, every day. And I did concrete work, so I usually had concrete all over me. It's in my hair, it's on my skin. Even if you brush it off, I get these big gray patches. So I was kind of self-conscious about it. But I went and walked in, and first she didn't even look up from her work. And finally she looked up and said, well, what do you want? And I said, look, I know that I've had a problem with drugs, but I've been through this treatment program. I've been clean now for over a year. I just want a chance to go back to school. And she said, we don't want students like you here. We have got lots of nice kids that want to go to school here. We don't need people like you. And I didn't even know what to say. She went back to her work, and I finally realized the interview is over, and I got up and walked out, and I thought, I'm not going to let this happen to me. I'm just not going to let it happen. And I said to her secretary, isn't there somebody else I can talk to? And she said, well, you can talk to the president of the university. As if, not like he's going to pay any attention to you, but you can talk to him. And so I said, well, okay, I'd like to talk to him. And I sat down, I waited about an hour until he had a break, and I went in. He's got, he's got a great big, impressive, imposing desk, and he's got a suit and tie on. And I, explained that I had this drug problem, but I really wanted a chance to get back to school. And he said, well, what do you want to take? And I said, well, I thought maybe I could, take a couple of classes at night. And he said, no, that's not going to work. And I looked down at my shoes, and I just didn't know what to say or what to do. And he said, okay, I'll tell you what. I'll let you take one class at night. And if you do okay, come back and talk to me. And I thought, that's all I need is a chance. And I walked out of there, and I walked across campus, and it was just a beautiful spring day. And there's kids walking with carrying books and, little groups, and twos and threes talking and laughing. And I thought, you know, I'm not that dumb. I'm just not that dumb. I'm sure there's got to be a way to pass these classes. And I thought, you know, I bet somebody's written a book on this. So I went to the bookstore. I didn't have a car. I had to take a bus. So the bookstore was on the way to the bus stop anyway. And I went to the bookstore, and I asked the manager, and I thought he was going to laugh at me. I said, do you have any books on how to study? And he said, you know what, over there behind that rack, I think there's a book on how to study. And there were two of them, and I bought both of them, and I took them home, and I started reading them on the bus, actually, and I read them three times each. What do you think they said?
Study.
Yeah, show up for class, first of all. Go to class, which I never did. I never went to any classes. Kind of like AA, you know, go to class, do the steps, you know, read the big book, pay attention. So sit in the front row, because if you sit in the back, all you're going to do is look out the window or look at the girls, and you're not going to pay attention. And that's all I ever did if I went to class. So I started doing that, and I got an A. You know, I mean, nobody was more amazed than me. And I took a couple of more classes, got a couple of more A's, and managed to get some scholarship money and went full-time the next year and kept getting straight A's. Got straight A's for 2 years and got transferred to Columbia in New York, Columbia University, and did real well there. Got not quite straight A's, but pretty close to it, and ended up going to medical school. And in those early days, I didn't drink, you know, but very, very rarely, maybe once or twice a year, because I'd get trashed and, you know, get into these pickles all the time, which is always what I did. But as time went on, I began to have more confidence in being out there in the world. And so my drinking, and I wanted, you know, I mean, I like drinking, but I also wanted to fit in with the other kids. You know, the other kids were drinking and going to beer parties and all this stuff. And I have a medical problem. I have insomnia. Especially if I don't go to sleep. And I was studying this, all these pre-med classes and chemistry and physics and all this stuff. And then I couldn't sleep at night. So I thought, you know what, if I just had a beer, it would relax my mind. And I think it helps the equation set in the brain tissue also. At least that was my theory. And I had a beer, and doggone, I went right to sleep. And you know, after a week or so, then it was two beers, and then it was three beers, and four, and five, and six. And then I'm up all night peeing. So I thought, well, I need to drink that bourbon. You know, that's what I need, because you don't have to drink as much. And I started, and you just start out with a little, you know, water glass full, and then you have a couple of water glasses, and pretty soon you kind of level off at a half a quart a night. And I could do that for quite a while. And then I'd go out to, I'd be on a date with, you know, somebody I didn't know, and I'd be nervous, and I'd overdrink and drink a whole quart, and then I'd lose my car, or I'd, make a move on the wrong guy's girlfriend, or, you know, whatever it was. I mean, you fill in the blank, you know, I always got into these pickles, and then the next day, whoever I'm dating would not be speaking to me, and she'd say something like, you know, after a couple hours of the silent treatment, she'd say something like, "Don't you remember what you did last night?" And I always said yes, and I never one time ever remembered. I never had any idea what I did last night, and I, you know, go out and look at my car, see if there was any blood on it, or if I, you know, hit anybody. I was just definitely afraid of that. I mean, it didn't stop me from driving, but and then I call up the people that we were with, you know, and try to figure out and, you know, piece it together, and sometimes I'd have to, of course, I'd have to apologize and over and over and over, and but sometimes I'd have to make that ultimate commitment that some of you may have made from time to time, and I'd quit drinking, that ultimate sacrifice, and I got good at quitting drinking. I could quit drinking for a day. I could quit drinking for the rest of the weekend. I could quit drinking for a week or a couple of weeks or a month. I got so good at it, sometimes I quit drinking every day. I'd get up in the morning and I'd quit drinking by 9 o'clock in the morning. And by 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I'd be thinking, what did I do? Why did I quit drinking? What was that all about? I don't even remember. You know, that was a hasty decision. And I start drinking again, and I just go back to that same old pattern, you know. And it would I'd drink more and more and more every night, and until I was drinking about a half a quart and kind of level off, and then I'd, you know, one night something would, for whatever reason, I'd drink a whole quart, and then I'd be, I quit drinking that bourbon. I was, I went on to finish college, did real well, went to medical school, and I was in the elevator with Dr. Friedman, I think was her name. She was a little radiologist, little short lady, very nice lady, but it was just the two of us in the elevator. And this is like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And she says to me, "Have you been drinking?" Well, I mean, that's pretty rude. I hadn't been drinking since the night before. I quit drinking like at 6 a.m, you know, before I went to class. So I wasn't drinking that day, technically. You know, I did sleep a little bit before I went to class. But I thought, you know, it's that darn whiskey. That's that bourbon. That's what it is. I need to quit drinking that bourbon. So I switched to vodka immediately. You know, I'm no fool. I realized that Red Label Smirnoff, though, just tastes like water. You got to drink the Blue Label if you really... Otherwise, you think... I always thought somebody was watering it down, you know, putting water in my red... But if I drink the blue stuff, I can taste it. And so that's what I drank for the next, I don't know, 20 years. I came out here to California. I trained at Johns Hopkins, and then I came out here to UCLA, and I hitchhiked out to San Bernardino. I'll just throw this little one. I hitchhiked out to San Bernardino, and I just finished. This is before this, but it's a good little story. When I was 20, before I moved in with Mrs. Weiland, with Peg, I came out here to San Bernardino, and I had just finished kicking a little heroin habit, and so I was, you know, hungry a lot, and I didn't have any money, so I sold some blood and got some lunch, and I bought 2 pints of T-Bird. Did you ever drink T-Bird? Oh, it's good stuff. I like T-Bird. With Kool-Aid, I like it. But I like it plain, too. So I drank that T-Bird, and I was sitting in the park and talking to this little chick. I met this little chick with no shoes on, beads. It's 1968. I said, "Hey, we're going to Haight-Ashbury. You want to come?" She says, "Yeah, I'll come with you." I said, hey, we are. This is what I want to do." And next thing I know, some Hell's Angel dude comes over and kicks me in the back, wants to cut me up. He says it's his girlfriend. She says it's not. Police came over and broke it up and asked me what I was doing there. I said, "Well, I thought I'd settled here, you know." He said, "Why don't you just keep moving on and settle someplace else?" So I came out here to L.A. I moved into the bus station. Slept in all-night movies, 50 cents. You know, drank T-Bird, panhandled. You could panhandle for a living in those days. I don't know if you can do it now, but back in those days you could. Now you can't tell. I got arrested a couple of times, but don't tell anybody because they dropped the charges if I would leave the state and not came back. So they don't know I'm here yet. Anyway, so I came out here to train at UCLA, and I figured they wouldn't remember anyway. You know, it was a long time ago. But my drinking was coming with me, you know, and it was just causing me more and more problems. My drinking years were kind of a blur because I drank to blackout every single day for 25 years, just day after day after day. And I ended up going into emergency medicine. Emergency medicine is a great... If anybody here is thinking of medical school, emergency medicine is great for an alcoholic because you're either on or you're off. It's not like you have this on-call stuff. You know, working in the ER, you're either on or you're off. And when you're off, you do what you want. Now, they did complain if I smelled like vodka, though, when I came back to work. And it's not, and I don't think they ever smelled it because you're not supposed to be able to smell it, you know. So it's just... But there's a lot of picky people, you know. I have found in my life I'm like a magnet for these picky people, you know, that want to mind my business. That is none of their business. I ended up owning a practice out in Rancho Cucamonga. I finally ended up with, I had about almost 60 employees and another 20 doctors that worked for me. It was a big practice. Made a ton of money. Had no money. spent every penny of it before I got it. All I had was bills. I worked all day and got drunk all night, every night, every single night. I'd start drinking that vodka. And my life was just kind of miserable. And I thought, well, maybe I should get married. I didn't have a girlfriend at the time. I had had a girlfriend who broke up with me because I was drunk all the time. And she wanted to get married. But that finally fell apart. And I thought, well, maybe she was right. Maybe I should get married. But she wouldn't go out with me. So I found this other a cheerleader. I was 42, and she turned 20 just before we got married. But we got married for the right reasons. Anyway, I quit drinking before the wedding, but at your own wedding you have to drink, and so the honeymoon didn't go well. I threw a watermelon. I didn't really throw it at her. I just was. It was a half a watermelon. I was trying to make a point, and. Anyway, things went downhill from there. We didn't stay together very long. But toward the end of that relationship, if you can use that term, I was never a closet drinker. You know, a lot of people, I don't know what that means, really. I was a kitchen drinker. I like to drink in the kitchen because I like my vodka cold, so I kept it in the freezer, and I just have a beer chaser or a Diet Coke chaser, you know, and drink that vodka. Nice cold vodka so you can taste it. But then I started to get, not that I was depressed, but I always felt like I should play with my pistol, my .44 Magnum, whenever I drank. And I would never keep bullets, I never keep a loaded gun, but I kept a box of bullets with it, and once I got drunk, then I'd put the bullets in it. And I'd take that gun and I'd put it against my neck, and I gotta tell you, it felt good. You know, it felt good. My life was so miserable. I was so spiritually lost and spiritually bankrupt, and I didn't know what to do. And I knew that I was gonna, not that I wanted to kill myself, but I knew I was gonna slip and pull the trigger on this thing. But I just couldn't help but keep pulling it out every time I got drunk. I'd bring it out of the closet and put those bullets in it and spin them and feel that cold steel. And my wife got tired of watching this. She left, which was fine. And I called up three old girlfriends that next week, because I hadn't been married very long. And they all said, don't call me until you get sober. One of them dropped off a big book. I mean, talk about rude. Here I am. I need comfort. And she's dropping this stupid book off. And I thought maybe it was my drinking that was making me so depressed, so I quit drinking for one day. And that just didn't seem to have any effect, so I knew it wasn't the drinking. And then one day I got up and I was just so depressed, I kept having these thoughts of shooting myself. And I called my manager and I said, I don't think I can come to work. I don't think I can listen to these patients, you know. I'm just so preoccupied with these suicidal thoughts. And she said, well, how about if I come over and we'll talk? I said, okay, good. So she came over and we chatted and she said, I think you need help. And I thought, and I said, well, like a psychiatrist? She said, no, I'm not a psychiatrist. You need a detox center. See, I surround myself with these picky people. That's what the problem is. So my whole life has been like that. So I thought, well, okay. So I called Betty Ford, and there are some rude people out there, let me tell you. I called Betty Ford. I explained to them the situation, and they start talking about 30 days in treatment. I said, look, today's Thursday. I got to be back at work on Monday. I'm committed to this, but I can only come for 3 days, you know. This intake person says, well, then you can't come here because this is a 30-day program. I thought, well, you know, I thought you were there to help people. I said, well, where else can I call? So she said, well, why don't you call La Jolla? So I called, I think McDonald's, is that the name of the program down there? Anyway, I called La Jolla, and the lady said exactly the same thing. I thought, how did she call her and tell her what to say? I dialed the number as soon as she gave it to me. And I said, well, I'm not coming for 30 days. I said, give me somebody else's phone number. I got good insurance. So she gave me Capistrano by the Sea. And I called up down there and I talked to Kathleen. I think, not this Kathleen, but another Kathleen, that was her name, right? Kathy? And she was a black belt Al-Anon, which I had no experience with. And she said, Dr. Kurth, we understand how important you are. And I thought, finally, I'm making some headway here. She says, now this is a 30-day program, but if you want to leave after 3 days, you can leave after 3 days. And I thought, that's wonderful. She says, now you'll have to leave AMA, against medical advice. I'm sure I can tell a lot of you guys are really bright. I have a keen alcoholic mind. And as soon as she said that, I said, I don't have to wait for your doctor to... I don't have to leave against medical advice because I'll advise myself to leave. And so I agreed to come. And then I remembered that I had another liter of that Blue Label vodka in the freezer. And I thought, you know, they're probably going to want me to throw this out, so I might as well just... Plus, I was celebrating. You know, you make a commitment to change your whole life. You want to celebrate. Cracked that label and started drinking that, and I forgot to go. The next time I realized it was the next day. And I called him up. I said, look, I was going to come yesterday, and I forgot. Things came up. Can I still come? And it sounded like they'd heard that story before. So they said, oh, yeah, don't worry about it. It took me like 5 hours to get ready. And I don't know why it took so long, but it took a long, long time to get ready. But I finally got down there. And the only thing I did do right was I decided I'm going to read that big book. I already had a lot of big books. I had, you know, the one that girl gave me, and I had Uncle Russ's big books because he always got sent to AA, and so he'd leave his big books at my house. I had a lot of big books. In fact, people used to drop them off at my work and leave them on the desk or mail them to me with no return address. Picky people. But I never read them. I only read down to the Hampshire Grenadier with a small cold beer, and I get there and I think, well, this got nothing to do with my life. You know, I got real problems. I have financial problems and girlfriend problems and wife problems. And so I never read the rest of it. But this time I decided I'm going to read it, even if it doesn't make any sense. I'm going to read it, and I'm going to go to the stupid groups that they have. And I started doing that stuff. And every day I'd go to the shrink, and I'd say, Jim McQuaid was his name. And every day I'd go, and I'd say, look, I got to leave. I got to go home. I don't want to be here. I got patients to see. I got bills to pay. And finally... I was sitting out on the little patio after group one night, and some guy who had been in treatment there 2 years before, then left, had a little relapse. He started drinking wine and came running right back to the program. I thought he didn't have much courage, you know, to come back that quickly, but that was just my opinion. But he knew a lot about AA, a lot more than the rest of us did. And we were sitting out there, he says, you know what the secret to this whole thing is? And I looked around to see who he was talking to, and there was nobody there but me. I said, what's the secret? He says, you got to get down on your knees, and you got to pray. And he said, all of these counselors that you see around here, Dennis, he mentioned, and some of the others, he said, they get down on their knees, and they pray every day. And I thought, if that's the secret, I might as well just hop the fence and go home, because that ain't going to work for me. You know, I tried praying. I prayed when I was in jail to get out of jail. It never worked. I lost a fishing lure once when I was a kid, and I prayed to get it back, and I never got it back. So I knew that all of that prayer baloney was just baloney. But I thought, what am I going to do? You know, I got no place else to go. And I went back in my room, and I shut the light out, and I got down on my knees. I didn't want anybody to see me. And I didn't know any prayers except like Thanksgiving grace, and I didn't think that was appropriate. But I finally said, well, God, you know, please help me get through this. And I waited for the windows to blow out or the roof to lift up or something, lightning, and it was nothing. And I thought, well, that didn't work either. And I got back up and I went outside where the other people were, you know. But I thought, you know what, I can, if that's what I'm supposed to do, that's what I'll do. I'll just get on my knees and I'll pray every day. And I started doing that. And a couple days later, the shrink came around and he said, well, I'm going to send you home tomorrow. And I said, you know what? I don't think my decisions have been very good lately. Why don't you decide when it's time for me to go home? And I ended up staying there 31 days, and then I went to their outpatient for another 4 months. And my first day back home in Rancho Cucamonga, I went down to our little Alano club, sat there terrified to go inside, and finally just took a deep breath and walked through the door, and there was only one chair left in the whole room. And I sat there, and nobody talked to me except one old lady came over and said, "Welcome to AA." I thought, oh, great, yeah. But that was fine, you know, and I thought, somebody had said go to 30 and 30, so I started doing that. And then somebody said 60 and 60, and I did that, and then 90 and 90. And nobody was more surprised than me that I was staying sober. I didn't believe in God at all, but I prayed every day anyway. And eventually I did learn to believe in God. When I was 6 months sober, I found out I had colon cancer. I was very sick. I was on chemotherapy for a long time. But I went to meetings every single day. I went to meetings and got involved and got commitments. And when the time came, I started sponsoring people. And I've had more commitments. Just whatever you can think of, I've probably done it in AA. Right now, I do a lot of H&I, which I love. I eventually got recruited to work at one of the treatment centers. I ran the treatment center at Loma Linda for 11 years. I applied what I do here in AA to my own community and ended up getting involved with the Chamber of Commerce, and I was president of that, and then I got elected to the city council, then I got elected mayor of Rancho Cucamonga. I served as mayor for 4 years. And that girl that dropped off the big book, the rude one, she called me up when I was 11 years sober. That was the one that wanted to get married, and then she wouldn't go out with me. And she said, "Hey, why don't we try this again?" And I said, 11 years later? You waited 11 years? She said, "Well, you were too crazy before." Sober. I said, "Okay, well, let's go out." And we started dating, and we ended up getting married a year later. We tried to have kids, tried, and just wouldn't work. We were both a little older, and tried in vitro stuff. That didn't work. And then finally, we went to adoption, and we adopted two little girls. One of them is now 4 and a half, and the other one's 3 and a half. Adeline is 4 and a half. Daisy Grace is 3 and a half. They are just absolute joys in my life. We've been married 9 years now. It's a wonderful marriage. I'm not saying it's a perfect marriage, but it's a wonderful marriage. I've had some health issues. 6 years ago, I had a series of heart attacks and bypass surgery, six-vessel bypass surgery, and then I had a stroke and a bunch of other crap. But you know what? I'm okay today. I'm okay. I've got a wonderful family. All of that, in a way, was a blessing because I had to quit work. I tend to be kind of a workaholic. I quit the university. I closed my urgent care center. I got a lot of time to play with my kids and do things that I want to do and drive down here to San Clemente to share my experience, strength, and hope with you. You know, I got a great life today. The kids, I tell you, are the blessing that when you get to AA, you know, you hear people say this a lot. Don't make a list of what you want because you'll sell yourself short. And that's what these kids are in my life. They're just absolute joys every single day. I just love them to death. And my wife as well. You know, I got a great life. If things aren't working for you, try reading the big book. Go to a few meetings. Work the steps. Get a sponsor. Get a commitment. Now, I won't say that you're going to adopt the most wonderful kids of the world or get elected mayor or become a doctor, but I'll bet you your life will get better. Anyway. Thanks a lot.